Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Salinas, California, and became a Navy fighter pilot. He was the first pilot shot down over North Vietnam on August 4th, 1964, and was a POW for 8.5 years before being released on February 12th, 1973. 40 years later, he's an author, lawyer, entrepreneur, and government executive. His name? Navy Commander Everett Alvarez. And we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Navy Commander Everett Alvarez, who was the first pilot shot down over North Vietnam and was the first, therefore, POW. Commander, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was born and grew up the first years in Salinas, California, which was basically an agriculture town before World War II. My parents grew up in the Depression period at a time. My dad was he dropped out of elementary school, the sixth grade. My mother went to the third grade. They had to join their families and work. They were married. They married. They were very young. And I was born in 1937, December. I remember when World War II broke out and my dad packed up my mother and my sister at the time and moved us to San Francisco, where there were jobs in the shipyards. And my father had to get some schooling to learn how to weld. Up until then, he had worked in a warehouse. He was just a laborer. During World War II, my dad and all of my dad's cousins and their families had moved to the Bay Area, and so they worked in the shipyards. And that was after World War II that my dad kept his trade as a welder and then became a sheet metal man. And it was after World War II that we eventually moved back to Salinas, and then I grew up from the third grade on, high school, graduated from the high school in Salinas. I was the first in my family to even go to high school. I went to a local junior college and then eventually to the University of Santa Clara, where I graduated in 1960 with a degree in electrical engineering. But all the time I recall growing up, there were several things that had deeply engraved in me. Even though we were very poor, we didn't know how poor we were. We were happy. And the other thing is that as a young boy, I can remember my mother packing me up a lunch before sunup and sending me with the relatives off to the lettuce fields and to learn how to work with them. And so the work ethic was something that was deeply ingrained. We learned at an early age how to make do with what we had. And there was another element here. My parents always instilled in me and my sister the value of going to school and education. Because my dad used to tell me, the only way you're going to get ahead, get an education. And in those days, we were fortunate in California growing up. We had a very good public school system. We were able to, and I was able to take advantage of that in my youth and growing up. And those are the things that stuck with me, the hard work.
Everett, how was it? When did you realize you wanted to be a pilot?
Well, in those days, growing up in Salinas, we lived on the outskirts of the airport property that during World War II, the Army Air Corps had built a base on the outskirts of Salinas. And it was an unincorporated area. Well, after the war, it was used by mainly crop dusting airplanes. And there were these old Stearmans that were parked out there and cannibalized. And as kids, we would run over and jump in these old cannibalized Stearman biwings and spent hours pretending that we were flying, you know, these machines. And then one day I was fortunate enough to have a family friend take me up for a ride in a Piper Cub over Salinas, and that was an experience. When I was in high school, I would notice that the kids that were in the junior college would be taking these exams to become pilots, and very, very few, if any, would pass the exams to become an aviator. But then later, when I was at the Santa Clara University, the school was almost in the path of the planes that were landing at Moffett Field, which is at the time was a naval air station. And the jets would be coming in daytime and sometimes at night. And I would just marvel at those. So I always had an interest, you might say, in trying that. And so as a senior, when I was my last year, and I was getting ready to graduate as a electrical engineer, and I had lots of job offers as an engineer, I had the opportunity to take the exam for pilot training for the Navy. And out of 55 college seniors, I was the only one that passed the written exam and the first part of the physical, which was the eye exam. Then I took the rest of the physical following that and passed that. And first hard decisions was to take one of the job offers and as a double E at something like $520 a month, or go into the Navy for $74 a month as a E1 and go into flight training. And I chose to do the latter. And I never regretted doing that.
We're talking to Navy Commander Everett Alvarez. And when we come back, we'll ask him about August 4th, 1964, a day that changed his life forever. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Navy Commander Everett Alvarez. Commander, tell us what happened on August 4th, 1964.
Basically, we were on deployment. I was a Navy pilot in a squadron that was on the USS Constellation, and we had been out in the Western Pacific out there, one of the three carriers that were usually deployed out in the far Western Pacific. And on August the 4th, the North Vietnamese torpedo boats attacked two of our Navy destroyers, the USS Maddox and the USS Turner Joy. So late that night, they launched A-4 Skyhawks from my ship to go and assist the destroyers who were under attack, and I happened to be one of those three, and we proceeded to go to fly to the vicinity. We found ourselves in a very severe thunderstorms. It was a horrible evening, horrible night in terms of bad weather. The ships called for someone to drop flares in the area if we had any, and I was the one of the three aircraft that happened to be carrying the flares, so I descended, and in those days, we used to drop our flares from about 2,500 feet. That would be released, and then a parachute would open, and they would drift down and light up the whole area. Well, I couldn't do that night. I had to drop down to about 1,200 feet, 1,200, because the weather was so bad, and I found myself at the base of all of the thunderstorms. I did drop the flares. I did manage to see our two destroyers and I was not able to see anything else that dark evening. We made our way back to the ship, and I debriefed the admiral what I had seen. Went to bed. Next day, they woke me up and said, I'm going on a mission. And it was our very first launch into North Vietnam. So our squadron and the flight that I was on, I was lieutenant junior grade. I was flying wing on the executive officer of the squadron, commander. We hit the most northern base on the Vietnam coast up close to the China border. However, while we were briefing to launch, President Johnson at 11 p.m. East Coast time, I later found out, got on the air and announced that we were retaliating for what happened the night before. We did not launch until 2 p.m. out there, and then it took another 2 hours to reach a target. So actually, by the time Johnson announced it, the North Vietnamese had 5 hours, and they were waiting for us. So when we went in and hit the naval base, the whole area just opened up on us, and I was unfortunate that I was hit. I was very lucky to get out of the airplane. And I was immediately captured by local militia that patrolled the coast of that part of North Vietnam and became the first captive.
They beat you. They starved you. You were in solitary confinement for 15 months. How did you survive mentally, Everett?
Well, you know, it's something that you don't really train for something like this. It's something that's intuitive. And looking back, I would say that it's when you find yourself in a situation like that, it doesn't take long to realize that you're just going to have to do the best you can one day at a time. And I will admit, it was very, very hard. First couple of months, because I was alone. Not so much alone, period. It was just the fact that not only were there no relations between the U.S. and the North Vietnamese government. I was halfway around the world, and I knew my government was there. I knew my country was behind me. I knew my family was supportive. But still, you know, in dealing with something like that, I called on what I felt I needed, and that was thinking back when I was growing up, I had been an altar boy at the Catholic Church, and I remembered some of the prayers, and I made it part of my daily ritual to imagine I was serving Mass and saying some of the basic prayers. I found that to be a part of my routine that I found extremely helpful. I also found that it was very difficult to keep in mind that whatever happened, I always needed to do what was the right thing. And I will not, you know, try to play down the fact that they really worked on me and with propaganda and with trying to convince me that that the United States was the villain and that we were wrong, and I was a criminal, and I was going to be executed, and on it went. And even then, they got pretty rough sometimes. But you always kept in mind that no matter what, and I didn't know if I was going to survive and live through this or not, but I needed to keep my self-respect, my integrity. And it's all part of the character of the individual, Mike. It's all part of who I am. Time went on, and the years went by. We were constantly being hammered by the captors, the Vietnamese, for propaganda. And they would get pretty rough sometimes forcing us to do this. It'd get, they would torture. Or you'd go for days and even weeks without sleep just deprivation of food, water. And they would break us, and we'd have to give in, but always with the thought that once we did, it was just a matter of getting by this one and then coming back and resisting again, because it was just the right thing to do. I could never look at myself if I had given them what they wanted without having resisted.
Here's a quote from Senator John McCain, a fellow POW. During his captivity, Everett Alvarez exhibited a courage, compassion, and indomitable will that was an inspiration to us all. His story, Chained Eagle, describes better than any account I have ever read our lives as prisoners of war. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Navy Commander Everett Alvarez, whose book, Chained Eagle, describes his 8.5 years in the captivity. If you want to learn more, www.alvarezassociates.com. Commander, when a new POW would show up at the Hanoi Hilton, what did you tell them and what did you ask them?
Well, the first thing you always wanted to do when you got a hold of one and they didn't know the tap code, because that was the primary means of communicating with each other, tapping on the walls or so it could be heard either in the other cell or outside of the cell by somebody. You want to make sure that you brought them in and into the group and part of the our organization, number one. Number two, I always wanted to find out what's happening in the outside world, and because shoot downs, as they would come in, were basically our source of information as to what was happening outside and what was happening in the war and what was happening at home, and especially like in 1967, 68, before the ceasefire, there was a lot to catch up with. And then if we went for 4 years without anybody coming in during the ceasefire while the Paris peace talks were going in. But then once those fell apart, and at that time President Nixon renewed the bombing and with such intensity that the number of airplanes being shot down were greatly increased, and the number of pilots falling out of the sky coming into our system greatly increased. We were flooded with news of every imaginable sort, and so it was in a way it was good, but in the other way it was, well, too bad, we got to stay here and wait a while longer till this war ends. And but things had improved by 1972 quite a bit.
You spent 8.5 years, over 3,100 days in captivity. What's the biggest thing you learned in those 8.5 years?
I think that, it didn't take me long to realize how precious life is and how lucky we are. How lucky we are to have been born and raised in a country like ours, and that's not just me, it's people who have spent time overseas, I think all realize the same thing. But how good it we have it here in this country. You know, politics aside, whether you are of one belief or the other, it's still people here in this country, but with the freedoms we have, there's no place else like it, no matter what critics will say. And it's revealing how people that live in countries that are run by totalitarian governments or regimes are held back, are held down, are not aware. That is one thing. The other thing, of course, is that life is short. And, you know, there's so many things that we should be doing to fulfill and enrich our lives, and how important family is, how important children are, and raising a family. basic things that, you know, as a young naval aviator, you know, you didn't think about these things. That was not foremost in your mind. But I think going through an experience like that and carrying forth, and no matter what a person does, is the importance of family, the structure, and having the opportunity to work and exist in an environment where character, your character, and the character of good people around you, in whatever you do, whether it's a profession or an organization or what have you, that's paramount.
In those 8.5 years, Commander, did God ever talk to you?
Oh, gosh. We talked every day. I chatted with God just like I'm chatting with you, in a sense. And it was, let's put it this way. God saw me through those times, and when they were hard, I remember the Hanoi March. July 6, 1966, they marched about 52 POWs through the streets of Hanoi and in front of the cameras of news people from around the world. We were on display, but the crowds were just beating the heck out of us, just whipping us and throwing rocks and bottles and things at us, and we were tied. And I didn't know if we were going to make. I didn't know if we were going to make it, and I prayed hard. Prayed hard, but somehow we all came through, and we came through unscathed. That we were all bruised and bloodied, but we were alive, and it was. My faith is that God was watching over us.
Captain Guy Gruders, a fellow POW, and I quote now: "Courage is fear that has said its prayers." Father Ted Hesburgh of Notre Dame puts it this way: courage isn't the absence of fear, it is acting with integrity in the face of fear. Commander, talk to us about courage, please.
I have to agree with Father Hesburgh's that. I know Guy Gruders very well, fine person, and I think he's right also. I see courage in the sense when we were, best example I can give you is that we were going through a process there where they were coming cell by pulling people out cell after cell. First one day and then another cell the next day and then finally, and you knew that they were going and they were just beating the hell out of people, putting them through torturous processes to obtain information, biographies, and so forth, and propaganda, and statements admitting you're a criminal, and so forth, and so forth. And they would go to extreme means, and some people didn't come back from those sessions. But and so when you talk about courage, it was the fact that you knew your turn was coming up next, and you were afraid. I was afraid. I was in fear because I'd hear the keys jangle and wondered if it was our turn, and they would open up somebody else's cell, take the people out, and I would breathe a sigh of relief as a wave of relief swept over me, because it wasn't my cell, it wasn't my door they were going to open, but it was somebody else's, and I felt sorry for those guys. And however, you know, I knew that I had no choice, that when it was our turn and they opened my cell, I was going to go in and go forth and face it. I had no choice, whatever it was, and take whatever they were going to do to the best of my ability. And so the day came and they took it, and I said, well, and there were two of us in the cell, and I said, I'll see you later, I hope. I didn't see him for 2 weeks. And, you know, having to go through punishment, deprivation. But I knew that if I didn't face up to it, I wasn't, it's not so much of what my country and my military service expected of me, Jack. It was what I expected of myself, my standards. And that's, so when I talk about this, I think we all did it. I think that's courage. I think that's a description of courage. Because it was the right thing to do.
We're talking to Everett Alvarez. When we come back, we'll ask him about February 12th, 1973, one of the greatest days of his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Navy Commander Everett Alvarez, who was the first American aviator shot down over North Vietnam in August of 64. 8.5 years later, Everett, February 12th, 1973. Tell us about that day.
Well, that was a day, Jack, that we had long anticipated. It was long overdue, in my view. Having gone through so many emotional ups and downs with a cessation or a pause in bombing, and finally in 1968 with the Paris peace talks talking, the leaders of both countries talking, and the cessation of bombing, and we thought we'd be going home, and then down after 6 months of nothing. And then, you know, so you've had so many ups and downs, and but finally, after Christmas of 1972, when the B-52s were bombing all night and other planes were bombing day all day, and the Vietnamese had had it, that the bombing stopped, we knew that was it. And then a couple of weeks later, here comes the wagon loads of clothing and wagon loads of shoes and paraphernalia to go home, and we knew it was here. And so the night before, on February the 11th, they took the first 40 people that were shot down, and they said, we'll be the first group going out in the morning. They gave us our clothing to wear, and we would be leaving the prison, and we would be heading for the airport. So I remember that night. It was hard to sleep. There's a Marine Lieutenant, a Marine Major, Howie Dunn, who's deceased now, but he couldn't sleep either, and he kept saying, Alvy, they called me Alvy, and that was my nickname. Alvy, we made it. Can you believe it? We made it after all these years. And the next morning, you know, it's like a dream. I remember we lined up the first group, and we marched, and we waited for an hour and a half inside the courtyard of the main gates, thinking, and I sort of became cynical, thinking, well, here I am up again. We're going to go back. Another emotional letdown coming. Then they opened up the main gates. We boarded the buses. We drove, and then they stopped the buses, and we waited another location for another couple of hours while the peace talks had broken down, as we heard, and then they told us, nope, we start up again. I eventually got it to the airport, and we look out on the ramp, and I could see these American airplanes, and there's this big C-141, and we had to go through the line, and there was a table, and there was an American officer and a Vietnamese officers, and we marched up. I was number one. Bob Shoemaker, who's now a retired admiral, was number two, shot down. And so we were together, and the others behind us. And It was just, I kept saying to myself, I'll believe it when I'm on that airplane. And they called my name. I stepped forward. A fellow escorted me to the plane. I walked up the ramp of the C-141. There were some Air Force nurses there. What a beautiful sight. First women we've seen in 8.5 years. The plane finally was loaded. We started the engines, and I was sitting with Bob Shoemaker, and I said, Bob, I hope we don't break down and have to go back. But when that plane took off, and we broke ground, and the plane, everybody that was on that flight just erupted. I couldn't shout with joy. I remember sitting next to Bob, and I turned to him, and we had a soft drink. They'd given me a soft drink, a can of something, Coke. And I toasted him, and he toasted me, and we just said, well, congratulations, we made it. And I think, basically, emotionally, I was spent. But it was just great. It was wonderful. A couple hours later, we landed at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. And what was very surprising to me, as we stepped off the planes, there were hundreds and hundreds of people with flags, lots of cameras, TV, media. Lots of signs says, welcome, we love you. And I really, really never expected that. And it was like becoming an instant celebrity.
Little more than 3 months later, you get a call from the White House. And President Nixon decided to invite the 590 POWs and their families for what is still the largest dinner ever held at the White House. Tell us about that dinner on May 24th, 1973.
Well, I had been to Washington before passing through, and I had met this young lady at Dulles Airport. She was a PR person for United Airlines. That her job was to handle the VIPs out of Washington, D.C. for the airline. And so I happened to be a VIP. And so when we had a call that, you know, inviting us to the White House, I didn't know. So I thought about it, that I called this young lady, and I asked her how'd she like to go to the White House, and she accepted for the dinner. And it was a fantastic evening. President and Mrs. Nixon were most gracious, as was the whole White House staff. They completely opened up the White House. We could just go throughout the White House, except for their personal bedroom quarters. We had the run of the place. They had a huge tent in the lawn. We had a great dinner. We had every celebrity there. And I was lucky that I sat at our table. The celebrity we had at our table was John Wayne. And I could not believe it, because here he was, the Duke, my hero, at the same table. And he looked at me, and I learned later on that he thought, man, he was just overcome, because he was sitting at the table with me. I never could figure that one out. But it was a fantastic evening, and Irving Berlin's saw it was there. Lots of songs, lots of Hollywood celebrities. And I made such an impression on my date that we continued to date. And then about 6 months later, we were married.
Now, when you asked Tammy, would you like to go to the White House, did she say,
absolutely,
well, Alvy, yes. I'd love to, but I've got nothing to wear?
No. Well, she told that to somebody else because they went shopping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Earlier this year, there was a 40th anniversary at the Richard Nixon Museum and Library.
That's correct.
And 200 POWs came back. Tell us about that evening.
Well, we wanted to recreate, and I'm on the I'm on the board of the Nixon Library Foundation. So we wanted to recreate on this occasion the original White House dinner. And it was at the library. They have the East Room. And so the event we had was at the East Room. We had 200 and their spouses, 200 guys plus their spouse come. And it was a very elegant, very nice affair. We had another event the day before there. I mean, we had Tony Orlando show up and saying we had people, and we had a lot of memories, a lot of things that were recalled of the event 40 years prior. Trisha Nixon Cox came and was with us, and her family. So it was we all figured it was one last big hurrah, because we're losing them. We have lost five of our group since that May event. We've lost, and you know, we're getting to the age where we're starting to lose people. We wondered whether or not we should wait until the 50th, but we said, no, let's do it now. Most of us can do this. And it was a fantastic event. The citizens of Yorba Linda came out and just gave us a huge reception. The library staff and people came out and just did a tremendous job. And it was just a great, great feeling to be with all the old, some of the old guys, a lot of the old guys that we were with, seeing each other again, and what a great setting that was.
Commander, what a hero, what an inspiration. Thank you for the service to America, and please keep doing your best every day. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.